Chapter 52. "Still holding southwards," Sean observed. "3 days riding and they haven't altered course."
"Looks like LaRue's got his teeth into something," agreed Saul.
"We'll halt for half an hour to blow the horses." Sean lifted his hand, and behind him the column lost its shape as the men dismounted and led their horses aside. Although the entire unit had been remounted a week before, the horses were already losing condition from the long hours of riding to which they had been subjected. However, the men were in good shape, lean and hard-looking. Sean listened to their banter and watched the way they moved and laughed. He had built them into a tough fighting force that had proved itself a dozen times since that fiasco a year ago when LaRue had caught them in the mountains. Sean grinned. They had earned the name under which they rode. He handed his horse to Impijani and moved stiffly towards the shade of a small mimosa tree.
"Have you got any ideas about what LaRue is up to?" he asked Saul as he offered him a cheroot.
"He could be making a try for the Cape Railway."
"Yeah, he could be," Sean agreed, as he lowered himself gratefully onto a flat stone and stretched his legs out in front of him. "My God, I'm sick of this business. Why the hell can't they admit it's finished? Why must they go on and on?"
"Granite cannot bend," Saul smiled dryly. "But I think that now it is very near the point where it must break."
"Oh, well, we thought that 6 months ago,"
Sean answered him, then looked beyond him.
"Yes, Impijani, what is it?"
Impijani was going through the ritual which preceded serious speech. He had come and squatted half a dozen paces from where Sean sat, had laid his spears carefully beside him in the grass, and now he was taking snuff.
"Ngosi."
"Yes?" Sean encouraged him and waited, while Impijani tapped a little of the dark powder onto his fingernail.
"Ngosi, this porridge has an unusual taste," he sniffed and sneezed.
"Yes?"
"It seems to me that this spoor has changed,"
Impijani wiped the residual snuff from his nostrils with the pink palm of his hand.
"You speak in riddles.
These men we follow ride in a different manner from the way they did before."
Sean thought about that for a few seconds before he saw it. Yes, he was right. Where previously LaRue's commando had spread and trampled the grass in a road 50 feet wide, since this morning they had ridden in two files, as though they were regular cavalry.
"They ride as we do in Ngosi, so the hooves of their horses fall in the tracks of those that lead. In this way it is difficult to tell how many men we follow."
"Well, we know they're about 600. Hold on. I think I see what you...
Ngosi, it comes to me that there are no longer 600 men ahead of us."
"My God, you could be right."
Sean jumped up again and began to pace restlessly.
"He's splitting his commando again. We've crossed a dozen rocky places where he could have detached small groups of his men. By evening we'll be following less than 50 men. When that happens, they'll break up into individuals, lose us in the dark, and head separately for a prearranged rendezvous."
He punched his fist into the palm of his hand.
"That's it, by God!"
He swung round to face Saul.
"You remember that stream we crossed a mile back? That would have been an ideal place."
"You're taking a big risk," Saul cautioned him. "If we go back now and it turns out you're wrong, then you've lost him for good."
"I'm right," Sean snapped. "I know I am. Get them mounted up. We're going back."
Sean sat his horse on the bank of the stream and looked down into the clear water that sparkled over gravel and small round boulders.
"They would have gone downstream, otherwise the mud they stirred up would have washed down across the ford."
He turned to Saul.
"I'm going to take 50 men with me, so as not to raise too much dust. Give me an hour's start, and then follow with the rest of the column."
"Mazel tov," Saul grinned at him.
With a Zulu tracker on each bank, Sean and Eccles and 50 men followed the stream towards the northwest. Behind them, the mountains of the Drakensberg were an irregular pale blue suggestion against the sky, and around them the brown winter sere felt spread away in the folded complexity of ridges and the shallow valleys. In the rocky ground along the ridges grew the squat little aloe plants, holding up their multiple flowers like crimson candelabra, while in the valleys the stunted thorn bushes huddled along the course of the stream. High, cold cloud obscured the sky. There was no warmth in the pale sunlight, and the wind had a knife edge to it. 2 miles below the ford, Sean was showing his anxiety by leaning forward in the saddle and checking the ground that Imbijani had already covered. Once he called, "Imbijani, are you sure you haven't missed them?" Imbijani straightened from his crouch and turned slowly to regard Sean with a look of frigid dignity. Then he shifted his war shield to the other shoulder, and not deigning to answer, he returned to his search. 50 yards further on, he straightened again and informed Sean, "No, Inkosi, I have not missed them." He pointed with his assegai at the deeply scarred bank up which horses had climbed, and the flattened grass which had wiped the mud from their legs. "Got them!" Sean exulted in his relief. Behind him he heard the stir of excitement run through his men. "Well done, sir!" Eccles's moustache twitched ferociously as he grinned. "How many, Imbijani?"
20, not more."
"When?"
"The mud has dried."
Imbijani considered the question, stooping to touch the earth and determine its texture. "They were here at half sun this morning."
The middle of the morning now. They had a lead of 5 hours.
"Is the spoor fat enough to run upon?"
"It is, Inkosi."
"Then run, Imbijani."
The spoor bellied towards the west, then swung and steadied in the same persistently southward direction, and Sean's column closed up and cantered after Imbijani.
Southward, always southward, Sean pondered the problem. What could he hope to accomplish with a mere 600? Unless, Sean's brain started to harry a vague idea, unless he intended slipping through the columns of infantry and cavalry that lay before him and trying for a richer prize. The railway, as Saul had suggested? No, he discounted that quickly. Jan Polis would not risk his whole command for such low stakes.
What, then? The Cape? By God, that was it. The Cape. That rich and lovely country of wheatlands and vineyards. That serene and secure land, lazing in the security of 100 years of British rule, and yet peopled by men of the same blood as Leroux and De Wet and Jan Smuts. Smuts had already taken his commando across the Orange River. If Leroux followed him, if De Wet followed him, if the Cape Burghers broke their uneasy neutrality and flocked to join the commandos, Sean's mind balked at the thought. He left the wider aspect of it and came back to the moment. All right, then. Jan Polis was riding to the Cape with only 600 men? No, he must have more. He must be riding to a rendezvous with one of the other commandos. Who? Delarey? No, Delarey was in the Michalisberg. De Wet? No. De Wet was far south, twisting and turning away from the columns that harried him. Zietzmann. Ah, Zietzmann. Zietzmann with 1,500 men, that was it. Where would they meet? On a river, obviously, for they must have water for 2,000 horses. The Orange was too dangerous, so it must be the Farl. But whereabouts on the Farl? It must be a place easily recognizable. One of the fords? No, cavalry used the fords. A confluence of one of the tributaries. Yes, that was it. Eagerly, Sean unbuckled his saddlebag and pulled from it his map case. Holding the heavy cloth map folded against his thigh, he twisted sideways in the saddle to study it. Here we are now, he muttered, and ran his finger south. The Pudder River. I beg your pardon, sir? The Pudder, Eccles. The Pudder. Very well, sir, agreed Eccles, with stolid features covering his bewilderment. In the dark valley below them, the single fire flared briefly, then died to a tiny glow. Already, Eccles, Sean whispered. Sir. Without raising his voice, Eccles placed affirmative emphasis on the monosyllable. I'll go down now. Sean resisted the impulse to repeat his previous orders. He wanted to say again how important it was that no one escaped. But he had learned that once was enough with Eccles. Instead, he whispered, Listen for my signal. The Boers had only one sentry. Secure in the knowledge that their stratagem had thrown off all pursuit, they slept around the poorly screened fire. Sean and Imbijani moved down quietly and squatted in the grass 20 paces from the high rock on which the sentry sat.
The man was outlined darkly against the stars, and Shaun watched him intently for a full minute before he decided.
"He sleeps also," Bijani grunted. "Take him quietly," Shaun whispered. "Make sure his rifle does not fall." Bijani moved, and Shaun laid a hand on his shoulder to restrain him. "Do not kill. It is not necessary." And Bijani moved silently as a leopard towards the rock.
Shaun waited, straining his eyes into the darkness. The seconds dragged by, and suddenly the boar was gone from the rock. A gasp, a soft sliding sound, and stillness. Shaun waited, and then Bijani was back as silently as he had left.
"It is done, Inkosi."
Shaun laid his rifle aside and cupped his hands over his lips, filled his cheeks, and blew the long, warbling whistle of a nightbird. At the fire, one of the sleepers stirred and muttered. Farther off, a horse stamped and blew softly through its nostrils. Then Shaun heard a pebble click and the cautious swish of feet through grass, small sounds lost in the wind.
"Eccles," Shaun murmured.
"Sir."
Shaun stood up, and they closed in on the camp.
"Wake up, gentlemen, breakfast is ready,"
Shaun shouted in the tahl, and each burgher woke to find a man standing over him, and the muzzle of a Lee Metford pressing into his chest.
"Build up that fire," Shaun ordered. "Take their rifles."
It had been too easy. He spoke roughly in the irritation of anticlimax.
"Bijani, bring the ones from the rock. I want to see how gently you dealt with him."
Bijani dragged him into the firelight, and Shaun's lips tightened as he saw the way the man's head lolled and his legs hung.
"He's dead," Shaun accused.
"He sleeps, Inkosi," Bijani denied.
Shaun knelt beside him and twisted his face to catch the light. Not a man. A lad with a thin, bitter face and the fluff of pale, immature beard on his cheeks. In the corner of his eye, a sty had burst to mat the closed lashes with yellow pus. He was breathing. Shaun glanced up at the other prisoners. They were being herded away out of earshot.
"Water, Bijani."
And the Zulu brought a canteen from the fire, while Shaun explored the hard swelling above the boy's temple.
"He'll do,"
Shaun grunted, and curled his lips in distaste at what he must do as soon as the lad recovered. He must do it while he was still groggy and bemused by the blow. From his cupped hand, he splashed cold water in his face, and the boy gasped and rolled his head.
"Wake up, wake up,"
Shaun urged quietly in the tahl.
"Wake up."
The lad struggled to sit.
"Where? You English?"
as he saw the uniform.
"Yes," Shaun snapped. "We're English. You've been caught."
"Umpol?"
The boy looked round wildly.
"Don't worry about him. He'll be with you on the boat to St. Helena. Leroux and Zietzmann were both caught on the Vaal yesterday. We were waiting for them at the Pudder, and they walked right into the trap."
"Umpol caught?"
The boy's eyes were wide with shock, still dazed and out of focus.
"But how did you know? There must have been a traitor. Someone must have told. How did you know about the meeting place?"
He stopped abruptly as his brain caught up with his tongue.
"But how? Umpol couldn't be on the file yet. We left him only yesterday."
Then, sickeningly, he realized what he had done.
"You tricked me," he whispered. "You tricked me."
"I'm sorry,"
Shaun said simply. He stood up and walked across to where Eccles was securing his prisoners.
"When Captain Friedman arrives, tell him to bring the column into the garrison at Vereeniging and wait for me there. I'm going ahead with my servant," he said abruptly,
then called across to Bijani.
"Bijani, bring my horse."
He would trust no one else to carry the news to Aitchison. The following afternoon, Shaun reached the railway line guarded by its blockhouses and flagged a northbound train. The next morning, he detrained with soot-inflamed eyes, tired and filthy, at Johannesburg Station.